Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte with a program note. No TWiT this week. The TWiTs decided, I guess, to take a picnic day because it's such a beautiful day in Northern California. Couldn't gather them together, but there's good news. You're listening to TWiL, the first edition of This Week in Law with Denise Howell. We will be taking next week off for TWiT as well. I'm off on a geek cruise, but we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, please enjoy This Week in Law, Episode 1. Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 1 for October 22nd, 2006. Hank Barry. This Week in Law is brought to you by Dell. For great laptop or desktop deals, check out Leo's Picks at twit.tv/Dell.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of This Week in Law, part of the twit.tv network. I'm Denise Howell and I'll be your host for This Week in Law, which will come to you roughly twice monthly with a regular and semi-irregular panel of experts and thinkers in the area of internet law and technology. Today we have with us Kathy Kirkman, who's a partner at Wilson Sonsini in Palo Alto, and the author of the astute and information-packed Silicon Valley Media Law blog. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Denise. Glad to be here.
Also on the call with us is Ernie Svensson, a veteran of both Hurricane Katrina and years of preparing for and trying cases. Ernie writes the Ernie the Attorney blog and practices law in New Orleans. Ernie, welcome.
Thanks, Denise. It's good to be here.
John Palfrey is a professor at Harvard Law School and the executive director of the esteemed Berkman Center for Internet and Society. John is pretty much a maven on all things internet and intellectual property law related. He's also the founder of a private equity firm called RSS Investors. John, welcome.
Thanks so much, Denise.
Hank Barry is a partner at Hummer Winblad Venture Partners and a former partner at Kathy's firm, Wilson Sonsini, and also at Cooley Godward. He's the former CEO of Napster, Inc., and an alumni of Stanford Law School, where he was the managing editor of the Stanford Law Review. Hank serves on many boards and is well-known in the internet and investing community, and we're very, very happy to have him as our special guest on the inaugural show of This Week in Law. Hank, thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
I also want to give some special technical thanks to a few podcasters who have helped us come online and bring the show to you here today, helped me specifically work my way through the audio equipment that we're using. And that's Paul Figiani of Gigavox Media, which is also home of my other podcast, Sound Policy, Steve Holden of Tech News Radio, and Victor Caio of the Typical Mac User, Typical PC User, and Immigration Tales podcast. All of these folks have been so helpful and so emblematic of the community spirit of the podcasting arena, and I just want to give some huge thanks their way for getting us all online today to do the show. So the format of the show basically is going to consist of going through some stories that we've looked at in advance and giving our thoughts and impressions and improvising on that. And I thought that we'd start out with something that Hank and I were talking about on a panel about a year ago, which is the MGM versus Grokster case and the way that it has raised its head again recently in the form of comments by Universal Music Chief Executive Doug Morris, who has come out in the last week or so with some fighting words for social networking sites like YouTube and MySpace. He's come out and said, that they believe these new businesses are copyright infringers and they owe the likes of Universal Music tens of millions of dollars, and has rather cryptically added that how they are going to deal with these companies will be resolved shortly. Folks, what do you think about all this? Is this just saber-rattling? Is this a serious threat under the precedent we saw established in the Grokster case? Hank, why don't we start with you?
Well, my own view is that really what's being called into question is the purpose of the DMCA and whether it is going to apply or have any meaning at all going forward. I think that YouTube certainly seems to be a place where people are extraordinarily careful about complying with the DMCA, and they seem to have really good procedures and processes in place. I think YouTube looks like kind of service provider that the DMCA was meant to cover, and the deal that the content industry that we all made, the service providers and the content industry made back in the days of the DMCA, was that the service providers would have the obligation to take the material down, but only upon receipt of a notice, you know, as specified in the statute. And I think the real question for us right now is that going to have any meaning going forward? Because if people don't acknowledge that to be the law and they continue to sort of threaten, it puts companies, startup companies, in a bad situation because they don't want all their money going to litigation, and they relied on passage of the statute in order to get going. So I think you've got Grokster out there as kind of a background, but Grokster is all about copyright infringement. DMCA is supposed to provide a safe harbor against claims of copyright infringement. So I think the real question in front of us right now is, does the DMCA mean anything going forward?
Well, I think that's right, and that it's going to be very interesting as cases against some of these video sharing sites go forward to see whether they come within the description of an online service provider as set forth in the DMCA. In some of the coverage that I've read, it seems like at least the plaintiff's attorneys in one case against YouTube have gone on record saying they're going to challenge that. John, do you think that they will have success or that these companies fall squarely within the online service provider definition?
I have to say that I hope that they are found to fall squarely within that context. I think Hank has nailed it, and I think that one other aspect of the cases or this perspective matter against the likes of YouTube is that we haven't seen that many applications of the Supreme Court's holding in Grokster. And of course, what happened there in essence was that the court didn't disturb the Sony rule, the thing that said basically that the VCR is okay so long as there are substantial non-infringing uses of a technology. But it added this thing about inducement and basically said that there were circumstances under which a company could be found to be liable, secondarily liable under copyright, if they were inducing people in certain ways to violate copyright. And so I think the DMCA is one question, whether they'll fall under that protection, and I hope the answer is yes. The second one is, how will courts apply this new or at least newly construed inducement rule? And I think that the YouTube guys actually have been pretty careful about threading this needle, and it seems like this is the kind of technology that that really ought to be protected so long as they're taking reasonable steps to deal with infringing material that we know is on there.
But one of the things that troubles me is the whole notion under the DMCA, in order to invoke the safe harbor, that the web host must be, if the web host is found to be aware of facts or circumstances from which infringing activity is apparent, then they're not eligible for the safe harbor. Is there a way that you think that video sharing sites can make a good faith argument that they aren't aware that infringing activity is apparent?
Well, I think that the answer really goes to Hank's concept about the original spirit of the DMCA, and I agree that there are arguments on both sides of this, but I do think the idea is to protect those entities that are doing a good faith effort to get rid of infringing stuff and not to hold intermediaries liable in this context. So, you know, whether or not YouTube would fall on the right side of those facts, that, you know, obviously remains to be seen. But I do think that, for the good of the internet as we go ahead, that certainty is really important, and this is the kind of thing that that ought to be set forth and on which we want investment to be made.
Ernie, what do you think about YouTube as far as being an online service provider or an ISP?
Well, I see it in two ways. One is as somebody who uses it, and to me, it's kind of doing what Flickr did for photos. It's allowing people to share videos that they have without having to host it on a site that they control or have to pay for. It eliminates incompatibility in format, so I don't have to worry about what, you know, whether they have QuickTime or whatnot. And in fact, it's kind of funny because last night, as I mentioned, the Monday night game is in town, so the city's alive. And last night I was walking down in the French Quarter, and there was this group of street musicians performing, and we stopped and started talking to them, and they asked us if we had any requests, and I made a request, and they started performing. And I've actually uploaded this little 30-second video to YouTube, and it's on my blog. And I thought about it because I was reading your the link you put to this fellow Ron from D.C., who's the lawyer who has his argument, which he's posted to YouTube, about how we can protect YouTube. And he has this notion that we should flag substantially non-infringing material as friend of the court video, FOCTV, I think. And then you could, people, the courts could see that this is substantial non-infringing use. So I thought of flagging this video. But then it occurred to me that I'm not sure that it is non-infringing, because the song that was requested was a spinner song. So that would be a performance, and it's probably a copyright infringement. And so you could run into this problem that of clearing rights, basically. And I think the public has no awareness of that. So it's really nice that Ron from D.C. is trying to enlist the legions of loyal YouTube users to help establish what is a non-infringing use, but really the average person has no idea of what a content holder would claim to be an infringing use. I mean, the Spider-Man movie, they got sued because they shot video in Times Square and the building owners wanted to sue them. So those sorts of issues, I think, are going to come out as well. Maybe not in the beginning with YouTube, but those are lurking in the background, and I find, to me, they're interesting because there is copyright infringement going on, even when people, when the average people don't think that there is.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You can think that you've cleared all the rights or created something completely original, but, you know, maybe there's even some stray background music or noise or a trademark or something that makes its way into your creation that you might not even be aware of that could wind up causing a problem. But your example is a really good segue, I think, into something else I wanted to talk about with you all, and that's the deal that has been announced and now formally confirmed by YouTube that Warner Music will be licensing its music for YouTube in a couple of different ways. First, I think you're going to see things affirmatively posted up there by Warner Music that people can view and share, etc. But the more intriguing thing that they're planning to do, and this is from the YouTube site, it says that Warner is the first record label to embrace and support your creativity by authorizing use of their music content for free in partnership with your favorite artists! Now, how that's all going to play out is somewhat unclear. As I understand it, I've seen it described, and some of this is speculation and some of this may be fact, that the notion will be that there will be some kind of guidelines or license provided for folks who are going to upload to YouTube and use Warner Music in their works, and there will be some sort of copyright detection technology implemented where videos will be scanned, and if there's something that potentially Warner might want to take a look at, they'll be able to do that, and then perhaps they'll be able to veto uses that they don't specifically approve of, which seems to me a bit draconian at first blush, but when you think about it, if what they're doing is creating a way to permit certain uses and not immediately resort to a flood of litigation about various uses that would otherwise be infringing, perhaps it's a good thing on balance for video site users. But that raises another point, too, is, you know, the license that Warner may be contemplating with YouTube may not say anything about people's rights to be able to create a work that they upload then somewhere else. And YouTube doesn't have exclusive rights to the things you upload there either. So I'm curious as to what you think about all of this, each of you, and if you think it's a good thing or a bad thing for YouTube's users. John, why don't we start with you?
Sure, Denise. I think that generally these kinds of experiments are really good. I think that what will prove itself out over time is whether the kinds of restrictions that the content owners are placing on them, whether that's in fact going to limit creativity in such a way that, that users don't want it and therefore it's not not a useful experiment. But I think, for instance, coupling this also with the Yahoo announcement about the DRM-less downloads and so forth that we're seeing other examples of, that, that these types of really embracing the digital technology by large firms is going to be helpful. And I think that the partnership with YouTube in particular suggests that, that some of these companies are in fact coming to where the customers are, which I think is a really big distinction from where things were, you know, when Hank and others were involved in an earlier generation of this.
Ernie, what do you think about this? Would it help address the situation that you were just describing?
I think we do kind of have to work our way down this path. I mean, I think in general the problem with that we're experiencing right now with all of these things is that there's so much new technology hitting us at once. And the first thing was the music P2P downloading, and we didn't really know how to deal with that. And Apple created a model that some companies liked, and the iTunes Music Store was born, and that's successful. And I think we're starting to see that there are ways to get there, but you have to try things. And this is where I agree with Hank. I think it's good because we're there's something there that we're working toward, and a lot of what happens on the part of the content holders is wanting to control the process up front and say no to things. And I think they're learning how to say yes on a limited basis, and that's the stage that we're in. And hopefully they're going to learn how to say yes more quickly and how to be more innovative in trying to look for opportunities as opposed to sealing things off.
Hank, what do you think about this whole veto power notion?
Well, I think that if you establish a right, you probably have to allow the person to enforce it, you know? And I think that the issue that I have with this announcement, which, you know, I applaud. I think Edgar Bronfman's actually a pretty forward-looking guy. The concern I have about it is, well, I have a couple. One is that, you know, we were just talking about the DMCA and safe harbors, and if I put on my investor hat for a second, I sort of don't like this development because it suggests that YouTube is somehow obligated, or could suggest, YouTube is somehow obligated to go through a licensing exercise with every potential holder of copyrighted work. And that seems to be exactly what the DMCA was intended to prevent. It was intended to allow a safe harbor for firms, service providers, so that they wouldn't be subject to these claims. So I'm sort of, I think it's a great development, but I'm sort of concerned about the premise of it, if you will. And then I'm also concerned about this notion of filtering as it relates to your veto, because I, to my knowledge, to my knowledge, I don't think anyone has successfully filtered music. And I take it that this is not going to be really be a video filter. This is going to be an audio filter that looks at the soundtracks and does the sort of comparisons that we tried to do in Napster and that Snowcap has tried to do for such a long time. But if you notice Snowcap's service that's been launched now with MySpace, is not a lookup kind of service. It's a service where you go and you post, and it's basically a store, an e-commerce place for digital goods. So if the premise of the deal is that there will be a filtering technology put in place by the end of the year, which I sort of take it as the deal, I think that's going to be, A, very technically difficult to do, and B, it leads you down this path of, well, that means we have to get licenses with everybody. And if you have to get licenses with everybody, it doesn't really mean you have to get licenses with everybody, because there are only a limited number of people who are interested in being plaintiffs in these cases. But the number of people who are interested in being plaintiffs, while limited in number, is not limited in resources, let's put it that way. And they can bring a lot to these sort of lawsuits. And so from the standpoint of a YouTube, you know, I don't even want to be in this discussion, I don't think. I think that I want to be relying on the law. I want to feel like I didn't do anything wrong. And I ought not to be in a situation where I'm sort of going hand in hand to people.
Right. Do you think that it could actually be damaging to somebody's fair use argument? The fact that there are affirmative licenses out there that are limited in scope. Do you think that a plaintiff would point to that as a way of countering somebody who comes out and says, you know, this is actually political commentary I'm engaged in, or some other form of fair use of this material, and I don't need a license?
Well, there's a lot better lawyers on this call than me, but I think that's something that, you know, you have to kind of parse through. I don't think those things are necessarily mutually inconsistent, but I'd be interested in hearing what John and Ernie and maybe Kathy have to say on that as a general topic.
Well, I think, I agree. It's not... Those two things don't necessarily coincide, but judges. The problem is you get in front of a certain judge somewhere, and the judge sees that somebody else is licensed. And somewhere in the back of their mind, if it's a bench trial, they get the notion that, well, that was done that way there, so maybe that is the way it should be done, and it's not a fair use. So from that standpoint, as somebody who might be facing a challenge later on, I wouldn't want to have seen that licensing system in place. On the other hand, I guess that's what I was saying earlier, is I think it's a stepping stone. I think these things that we're working through these things, because what's going to happen is it's not going to succeed because it's too cumbersome, or at some point something more fluid and expeditious will take its place. But the problem is that we want to make every one of these distribution problems, the bottleneck is the law, I guess is what I'm saying. And I wish that weren't the case, because I think that these new distribution methods, and they have beneficial uses. Users want them. I mean, YouTube is great for some people because they can see the Daily Show clips and, you know, share them with their friends, but that's not what its best use is, in my opinion. I think that there are a lot of other great uses of YouTube, and I think those things will come out if we find a way to let them come out. The problem is there are people who are going to try to prevent YouTube from being as fluid and evolving in the way that the users want to see it evolve, because they only see things with their lawyer hat and not with their user hat or their investor hat or their social benefit hat.
I've been giving Kathy a pass on all of this YouTube discussion because YouTube happens to be a client of her firm, and she understandably might not want to make too specific of comments about that. But Kathy,
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, in fact, I'd love to address it, but I'm just not at liberty to do so. I think the fair use topic, though, you know, setting aside anything about you know, sort of Web 2.0, I think it's just an interesting question there. You know, you have plenty of case law that involves situations where people have tried to obtain a license or not tried to obtain. So I think that ultimately it goes to, you know, the four factors that you look at in fair use, and that those would be considered on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, you would hope so. But there's so much uncertainty in the application of those factors as well. Hank, at one point, the original Napster was certainly relying on fair use as a cornerstone for its activities. Do you think...
I think we ever did, actually. I mean, I'd have to go back and look at the briefs that were filed, but I don't think that was a particularly important argument to us. We were much more focused on the Audio Home Recording Act, Betamax, etc. I mean, this was way before Grokster. I don't think that we really got much into that, although, actually, I remember David Boies making that argument at some point. So it was maybe argument number three in a six-argument argument.
Okay.
But I think that those are interesting arguments, and from a lawyer's perspective, it's a lot of interesting things to think about. But when you're dealing with a company and you're trying to build a company, I mean, this really points out the, I think in some ways, the failure of our copyright laws to acknowledge, deal with, whatever you want to say, the realities of the internet. And that's reason for that is that we haven't really thought that there was a need to address it. And because the entrenched interests are so entrenched, rightly or wrongly, that nobody's up for kind of addressing it because everyone's concerned they'll lose. Somehow in the process they'll lose. So you've got these laws that sort of can't be changed. I was involved in the discussion around the Induce Act a couple of years ago, and I thought that was a great exercise because it was very clear to the Senators Hatch and Leahy that there was no consensus on what would be a good mechanism to move forward with some sort of act, and so they didn't report the bill out of committee. And yet, the next year when the Grokster case came up, they both sent a note to the Supreme Court jointly saying the court shouldn't hesitate to rule just because Congress hasn't ruled in this area. So, I mean, so you end up with this strange abdication by Congress of its role and, in fact, an encouragement of the court to effectively legislate because the Congress is sort of, incapable of doing it. And, I'm not placing blame here. The blame is sort of in all of us. We can't kind of get it together to address these things. And I think it's a real shame that we are where we are because you take these specific companies, MySpace and YouTube, they have to look around at the statutes and they have to look around at the court decisions. And unfortunately, it doesn't give them a lot of guidance. It gives them contradictory advice.
Well, one of the encouraging developments in the last few years has been the coming onto the scene of Creative Commons and the spread of that kind of a licensing approach, which seems to, understandably, given...
I think that's actually a symptom of the problem, if you'll forgive me for being the most unpolitic person by saying that Creative Commons isn't the greatest thing in the world. The reason it's not the greatest thing is that it accepts the premise that reform of the law is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, since reform of the law is impossible, let's set up some other regime where we're all going to deal with this on a contractual basis because the statute isn't to anyone's liking. And it allows people like Hillary Rosen to say that she's very much in love with Lawrence Lessig. And the reason for that is that effectively... Professor Lessig, who I have a tremendous amount of admiration for, has said, look, we're not going to be able to change the statute, therefore let's go, develop our own regime that's contractual over here on the side. And I guess I admire the motive that's behind it, but I worry about the implication, which is, let's not really address these issues from a public policy perspective. Let's assume we can't get anything done and go have our own little world over here off to the side.
Yeah, I see what you're saying there, but the one thing that really strikes me about Creative Commons is its potential to be the exception that winds up gobbling the rule. Even though it sort of starts out from the point of capitulation, that we can't change the law, so what can we do to end run it? That it strikes me as the more the people use this kind of licensing, and the more this kind of licensing comes to be demanded by consumers of creative works, the more potential there is to actually shift the legislative agenda and change the law down the road.
Yeah, I think that's a good argument. I think that there's that you can argue that that's a way to, you know, foment change. But, you know, there's so much transaction cost associated with it that you wonder, gee, isn't there a better way to do this more quickly? And I think actually there is. I mean, if you look at the Cantu mechanism that was put into place in the mid-70s around the time of the Act, the 76 Act, there's a, you know, there's a historically proven way to look at new technology and figure out how it ought to impact the law. And it certainly worked there. They had 100 witnesses. They produced a big report, resulted in the passage of legislation to allow software to become a form of authorship, and that certainly has helped me and lots of other people. So I think that, yeah, you can do that, and I hope you're right, but there are transaction costs associated with it.
We'll be back with Denise and her guests in just a moment, but first a reminder that this podcast and all the podcasts on the TWiT Network are brought to you by Dell Computers. For a great laptop or desktop deal, check out Leo's picks. They're right there on the page, twit.tv/Dell. A very affordable laptop deal, some great desktop deals, and of course, I'm putting in my high-end laptop and desktop picks as well. It's all there, and if you're buying a Dell, if you'd do us a favor and go through that page, we'd get credit for it, and we'd sure appreciate it. Thanks to Dell for their support. twit.tv/Dell.
Can you tell us a little bit more? You and I have had that discussion before about the Cantu study you were just referring to, because I think that's really fascinating, and our listeners would be edified by learning a little bit more about
that. Well, in 1974, when they were on the verge of passing the 1976 Act or starting to work on it, there were two big issues out. One was library photocopying, and the other was whether computer software should be considered a work of authorship. And there were lots of debates back and forth. But the upshot of it was that Professor Nimmer and Mel Nimmer and I can't remember, he was the vice chairman. I can't remember who the chairman was. Were appointed to head a presidential commission to look into this, and it had I think 14 members. There were like four from the content community, four from what we now call the content community, four from people who used copyrighted works, and there were four people who were just, you know, smart people but had no particular interest in the fight, if you will. And they saw about 100 witnesses, as I said. They produced six very very lengthy reports, and they really went at this question in a methodical kind of way, with a lot of good faith on both sides. And I don't think we've done that here at all yet. Maybe we will.
Yeah, I think, this is Kathy, I think a challenge is that, and not to say that didn't exist at the time, is that, you know, for example, with the Induce Act, as you were mentioning, Hank, is that there are, you know, it's often sort of a situation where you can't make progress because there are just strong views on each side. We've got quite a few bills introduced in Congress, as you know, and at this point it doesn't appear going into the fall that really anything's going to go anywhere, although we have the Copyright Modernization Act that has been introduced, that has the orphan work piece, that has the sound recording, the 115 mechanical piece to it. But it's in terms of getting all the stakeholders, you know, together to come to some sort of a resolution. My understanding with the orphan works, you've got photographers who don't like it. With the 115, you have a question mark as to whether, you know, the sound recording, the record industry folks are going to support the deal that the publishers made. So when you look back at, you know, at a Creative Commons, I don't really think they're mutually exclusive in terms of approach. I think that Creative Commons is really leveraging the fact that there are going to be copyrights out there, and that's not, you know, in dispute. And so what can we do in terms of a mechanism that enables a solution, just like the way that the open source movement has had tremendous impact on the availability of software. There was just another case, I think in Germany last week, upholding the GPL as a license, and Creative Commons has had, I was actually involved in helping write the license, has had a couple cases also, you know, validating their license. So, you know, agree it would be great to modernize the law, but it seems that the law gets more and more Byzantine as, you know, as we go forward, more difficult to keep up and have that done legislatively, although it would be great.
Kathy, I'm familiar with the Dutch case involving Adam Curry and a tabloid that validated the Creative Commons license. Have there been others?
There, in February, there was a case in Spain in which a disco was sued by a performing rights society, and I guess there was some sort of a general presumption that if they, you know, said that their songs were being used, but the fact that the Creative Commons license was also used, that served to shift the burden back of proof to the Performance Rights Society. So the case didn't specifically, you know, address the Creative Commons license. It addressed the usage of Creative Commons license music in an infringement action.
So getting back to Hank's comment about transaction costs involved in Creative Commons, or Creative Commons, one of the transaction costs is just the difficulty under the world as we now see it of locating and making use of Creative Commons music. And one of the things that I think might be poised to tip that the other direction is this deal that was just announced where MySpace is going to be having an online store and selling commercially downloadable copies of the music made available by the bands there. And while certainly they're targeting, no doubt, signed musicians as well, over 3 million bands are already using MySpace, and most of them are independent. So it occurs to me that most of those folks are going to want to use some kind of more liberal licensing strategy. And though I haven't seen any indication that this is going to be the case, it seems to me very logical that Snowcap's going to have to give them that option. What do you guys think about the ramifications of having 3 million plus bands suddenly having easy access to Creative Commons licensing and music sales at the same time? Hank, what do you think of that?
Well, I think it's good. There's not, I personally don't have time to listen to 3 million bands, so somebody's got to kind of do a filtering algorithm here, and I'm sure that'll come into play over time. But you have a very specific question, which is within the regime that Snowcap has set up for the people who sign up for the Snowcap service, the bands that sign up and who want to sell their music online, is there a way that they can effectively license it through Creative Commons and not through some other structure? Or can they add Creative Commons type terms onto their license, i.e. you can sync this up with your video, no problem, we don't care about that? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. And one of the interesting things about it, I tried to read the terms of service of Snowcap on the MySpace page, and they've set it up so that you can't cut and paste the terms of service. You have to scroll through them, and they're in some form of document that does not allow you to cut and paste. So I've actually started the task of recording them word by word from one side of the screen to the other. And one of the interesting things about that license is it says that the person who's receiving the song grants to Snowcap the right to surveil their computer in order to determine whether they're complying with their license. And so I think people ought to dive down into that a little bit and find out what that's all about. But, it's one thing to say, well, Creative Commons, that's great. We all love that. That's wonderful. But people can use phrases like that and GPL, et cetera, to actually extract really onerous licensing terms, kind of in the name of, it's our way of sticking it to the man.
Yeah, absolutely. I should just mention, I've been trying to ring John back for the last 10 minutes or so. He dropped off the call a while ago, and I'm not sure. He must be having a technical issue or one way or another. He hasn't tried to ring back in, so we'll keep an eye out for him, but we've lost him for the time being. I'm curious, Hank, I think I know your answer to this question. I certainly was a Napster user back when it was under your stewardship. Kathy and Ernie, were you as well?
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, I had dial-up back then, so my ability to enjoy was not enhanced.
As did I think. How about you, Kathy?
Well, I worked on the Napster account with Hank here at Wilson, so...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Kathy was very helpful to us. Actually, everybody at Wilson was very helpful to us. If you look at the gross numbers from American law firms for the year 2001, I think we were actually right up there as a client for all the law firms in the United States during that year.
That's tragic to hear. But one of the things about the original Napster that was, of course, so compelling was its community aspect and was its ability to not just allow you to discover new music, but to discover it from folks that you had come to trust due to their taste in music jibing with yours. And it seems to me like MySpace and some of these other social networking communities out there today are managing to recreate that and are endeavoring to do it using a tool that wasn't available to you at the time, Hank, the DMCA, and leverage all that into something that works within our copyright laws. Are you optimistic that they will succeed?
Well, I don't think anybody's really cracked the code yet on recommendations, if that's the question. I mean, there's this notion of using community to find and recommend new music is a really powerful one. If you look at places like Last.fm, and I've recently looked at a company that I think is up now called The Echo Nest in Boston. These are all what I would call attention-based recommendation services where the users allow each other to look at their data in terms of what they're listening to, you know, what they're not listening to, what they have in their what they have in their iTunes or what they have in their libraries, and allow people to kind of connect the dots. Oh, this person's like me, therefore I might like this. And the challenge of all these services, of course, is that there's a serendipity about finding new music, and you do want to find something that isn't expected. You know, it's the unexpected that's really the good thing in recommendations. So I don't think we're really there yet, and whether MySpace and others can kind of get it together to tap into the power of their big communities in order to help people discover music, I think they will. I hope they will, but I haven't really seen that yet. I haven't seen one thing yet, and I look for it because I spend too much time looking for new music myself, personally. But I haven't really seen one yet that I think is great. I mean, the Pandora thing is good. Mm-hmm. They're all good, but they're not. They don't give you that sort of aha moment, at least to me, yet.
Yeah, I agree. For me, an aha moment with Napster way back when was, and this all has to do with the law of unintended consequences. I mean, I saw it as something that if I knew I wanted a song, I would download it. Not so much because I didn't want to pay for it, but just because I just wanted one song and I wanted to hear it. And I remember one time a bunch of friends and I were sitting around, we played music together, and we were playing some song, and the bass player said, oh, there's this, the song we just played was done by some other artist, and I forget who it was, but it was somebody obscure. We all looked at the bass player and said, you've got to be kidding, there's no way that person did that song. And he said, no. He says, do you have Napster? And I said, yeah. And he says, well, let's look and see if we can find the song. So we downloaded it. First of all, we could see that the song existed because it was there. So just in terms of a reference, it was a body from which we could consult and see that this song had in fact been done by that artist. And I, at that moment, I stopped and paused and I realized, wait a minute, there's something else going on here. You know, it's not just about downloading music for illicit purposes.
Yeah, there's a social good aspect to it, which I think is there in YouTube too. I mean, if you look at it, I think there's really a, I want to use the word librarians sort of focus on it. there's a great benefit to being able to see things, to see a lot of things. And I think that that's not rocket science. Everybody sees that. The question is, how do you create a world in which you can have these kinds of services where everyone can make money and the interests of copyright holders and the interests of the public can be protected at the same time? I think that we're still sort of a long ways from that. But, you know, I'm still young. Kathy's even younger than I am, so she'll probably live to see it.
I don't know, Hank, just barely. Well, I think, you know, Hank, a lot of your work has laid the groundwork for where we are today, you know.
Well, it's nice of you to say.
And obviously a lot of people had the aha moment with their iPods, but I think that has helped keep the impetus, you know, moving forward around digital music, et cetera.
Yeah, I do too, although the iPod is kind of interesting because for two reasons. One, it's a static device. I mean, it's not really bringing you things you don't already know, although the new music part of iTunes is getting better, I guess. And the other thing about it that's kind of interesting is that I don't think the numbers work. I don't think it pencils out. If you're a music company executive and you've got a $5 billion business and you've gotten your check for $60 million from Apple and Apple's feeling really good about it, you're not feeling really good about it because you have to replace a $5 billion physical goods business with something, right? I think that people are discovering that CDs are inconvenient. They come in these little plastic wrappers that you can never get off, and then they got this sticker on them that you just can't ever get unstuck. You know, whatever that adhesive is right there, that they ought to be using that for the space shuttle tiles right there. That is the adhesive, right? And finally, you got to find some place to store it, right? And then when you listen to it, it's 1979 technology. The Redbook audio standard it was put together in 1979. So it's a 16-bit audio standard. Denise right now today is recording this at 24 bits, 96 resolution. And, you know, it sounds better. So we've got this physical format that people are sort of locked into, which isn't really doing the job for anybody. I don't think it's doing the job for the consumer. I don't think it's doing the job for the record companies. And yet people don't seem to be willing to get off the dime. I mean, if you go into Tower right now or any of these many, many music stores that are owned by Trans World, you ought to check out this company, Trans World. If you look at any of these music stores, they're boring, you know, because they don't acknowledge the existence of the Internet. They don't even acknowledge the existence of computers, you know. They think everybody's carrying around like a CD player or something. And it's just kind of a strange institution that has locked itself technologically in about 1983, you know, early 1983, and yet it's kind of weird because I don't really think the iTunes store and Apple itself is enough in any way, shape, or form to really keep the recording industry going. And maybe you can argue, well, it shouldn't be going, etc. But still, it's a big industry right now, and it stands to get much smaller unless they figure out how to make this transition.
All I can say is over the weekend my 13-year-old son was complaining about video games and how they get scratched up and all that. He said, why can't we just download these, etc.? So, you know, people need to figure out the model if the 13-year-olds of the world, you know, can't put up with packaged goods.
Yeah, and you hand a CD or a DVD to a 2-year-old, and I can tell you that thing's shelf life is about 2 minutes. So.
Right. So I think that's exactly right. And I think that what we need, I don't know. Yeah. I like the idea of having another Comtu that actually does scientific research, that looks at DRM, looks at filtering technologies, looks at all of these issues. Because if you think about it from a sort of national policy perspective, we got to make this thing work. We got to make digital commerce work. We have to make commerce and digital objects work. And by work, I mean, yeah, take the game industry and change that from a physical goods-based business to an online business with the same economics, even better economics, for the game manufacturers. That should be the goal of that kind of a commission, is to figure out how we can do that and come at it from a very nonpartisan, you know, I would almost say sort of patriotic perspective, figure out a way to get this thing together, because otherwise we're just, you know, I think we actually stand a shot at ruining some existing businesses. We also owe the shot of not seeing the benefit of a lot of new businesses that could be formed, and we're all just kind of doing this dance that doesn't get us anywhere.
Yeah, and part of the dance involves litigation, which certainly just grinds everything to a screeching halt. I think a lot of our listeners would probably be surprised and or stunned to know that the Napster litigation goes on to this day. And in fact, there was just a settlement involving some of the parties in that case. Is that right, Hank? Can you bring us up to speed?
Right. Well, let me give you 2 seconds of background. In 2003, two of the record company plaintiffs, Universal and EMI, sued Bertelsmann. Bertelsmann was the company that contributed capital to Napster, and we had a strategic relationship with them. And then later that year, they sued me, my partner John Hummer, and the venture firm as well. And those cases got consolidated before Judge Patel in San Francisco. She's the judge who heard the original Napster case. And so they've been sort of trundling along, and I probably won't talk too much about our case, but the principal case, I think, in terms of, you know, its economic outcome was the case between Universal and Bertelsmann. At least those were the two biggest players that were around. And they settled that sort of contemporaneously with Universal buying, by Universal I mean Universal Music, a division of Vivendi, buying a catalog of publishing rights from Bertelsmann for about $2 billion. So the announced price of the settlement was $60 million. I don't know whether that's true or not. I don't have any way to know, really. But that, so that piece has been settled, and that part of the suit is no longer around. But, you know, there are still other parts of the suit around. So.
And the other suits, of course, that people hear about all the time are the RIAA suits out there against individuals.
Which are really tragic. I mean, people don't really realize what's going on there, I don't think, which is that, you know, way over 20,000 people have been sued. And the typical scenario is low-income family buys a computer, gets a broadband connection, kids are not well supervised, and they do a lot of downloading. RIAA uses mechanisms that they won't disclose to go after these people. They notify the service provider. They file a complaint. People are told to call this thing called the Settlement Support Center, which is used to be a collection agency up in Seattle. And that those people use extraordinarily heavy-handed techniques with these families to get them to settle. And they settle basically for whatever the family has in the bank. So if the family has $3,000 in the bank, then that's the settlement amount. If the family has $5,000 in the bank, that's the settlement amount. They sort of take all their money. And they stay on top of it in terms of making dunning calls from this boiler room in Seattle until they get people to settle. And it's something that journalists haven't focused on for whatever set of reasons.
Yeah, the greatest resource that I've seen on those suits is this RIAA versus the People blog that I sent you guys the link to.
Yeah, if you Google RIAA blog, it's the third link.
Yeah, that's Ray Beckerman. Now, Ray and a bunch of other defense lawyers have gone into this representing some of these families, and it's thankless work. It's just thankless work.
It is an amazing resource, though.
Yeah, that.
Yeah, but imagine you're Ray, and every time you go into court, you lose.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, every motion, every day.
What's that? Does Ray have the UMG versus Lindor case?
That's, I don't know.
It's the first post on their blog right now, if you go look it up, where there's an argument being asserted by the defendant. I'm not sure if it's Ray's, or he does a good job of covering all the other cases that he's not handling as well. The defendant is arguing that certain evidence should be excluded because Universal Music doesn't actually have the song files that she is, or her family, is alleged to have downloaded, which seems like a fairly fundamental piece of evidence to have in those kinds of cases. So, you know, who knows if
yeah,
those...
Yeah, but for every one of those that gets reported, there's 10,000 that don't get reported.
Yep.
Where people just pay up, you know. It's really a shocking thing. It's computerized litigation. I mean, they file these complaints en masse, you know, there's It's individual lawsuits, but it's like a class action, if you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. It's like thousands and thousands of defendants all brought – these cases all brought through the through computer technology. I'm sorry, Kathy.
I was just going to interject that if you want to look at this PowerPoint that's up on the internet of Mitch Bainwall, his comments last fall before they headed into this whole spyware thing, and you know, he at an industry meeting, he's basically saying that the user lawsuits are working. We will maintain our resolve and enhance deterrence. So I think that's their approach in terms of how they're viewing that as a, having a deterrent effect.
Intimidation, yeah.
Well, is there any kind of encouragement to be drawn by the fact that, you know, years and years have gone by since the filing of the original Napster lawsuit, and that there seems to be some kind of recognition that suing your customers might not be the most effective way of going about carrying out a business? Is there any kind of basis to be encouraged that we're going to see an approach that is more designed around partnering and enabling than suing and squelching? What do you guys think?
Well, I think we're on the verge of finding out something pretty important, because with Doug Morris's remarks a week or so ago about YouTube, it'll be very interesting to see what they do. I think Edgar Bronfen made some really good statements last week, and you know, we'll see what happens. I hope things can iron out. You know, certainly copyright owners have legitimate rights, and copyright is a good thing. I mean, we, you know, you can look at it and say, well, gee, you know, Hank, you're anti-copyright. I'm not. I started out as a copyright lawyer. I'm very, very, very pro-copyright. But we're in a situation right now where the rights have really been expanded, and people are taking even more expansive views of them than they are, if you will. And we've gotten into this really unfortunate situation where, you know, it's hard for people to exercise their legitimate rights. It's hard for potential defendants to know what the law is. I mean, it's both sides of the equation. We don't have a good situation right now. If you're a record company, I don't think you're really crazy about where you are right now. You're a copyright holder. You want your rights to be respected, and you want your you want to get the money that you want to make a return on your investment. That's all good. And if you look at the standpoint of the customers, they don't know what they're supposed to do. You've got look at a DVD, look at a CD, and look at a piece of software, executable code. They're all delivered to you on a little silver disk that slides into your computer. But the legal rights associated with them from a consumer perspective are very, very different. Mm-hmm. What you can and what you cannot do. And how are people supposed to know? I mean, how are they supposed to know? So it's really confusing from a consumer perspective. I think it's very confusing and extraordinarily expensive from a copyright owner perspective. I mean, just think of what these lawsuits cost. And so I just don't think we have a good situation. So I keep going back to my well-worn argument that we ought to have kind of a nonpartisan commission to look at these issues.
Hank, do you see any traction on that?
Well,
are you aware of any talk about that?
I'm merciless when I have my occasional meeting with Senator Leahy or Senator Hatch. I'm sort of merciless on the topic and kind of Johnny One Note. So I think there's a real hesitancy on the part of legislators to even get involved in this area, because it's kind of toxic. You know, it's just toxic. You got the copyright owners on the one hand and the consumers on the other. Let alone, I mean, leave patent reform all the way off to the side here, but I think just generally, if you're a legislator, you got many, many more things that are important to you. And by the way, if you talk to them, you know, they go talk to their constituents, and nobody cares about this. You know, this is not...
Yet.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not up there like Jobs and Iraq and the price of gasoline. You know, this doesn't affect a lot of people.
Well, it affects our kids, and you know, I have a 14-year-old and a 16-year-old, and I know that when they are in a position of having a job and knowing people who are on courts and who are judges, and their friends are judges, I think the world then will be very different because it will be important to them.
Yeah, and the other shift that I think we'll see happen more and more over time is the market dictating what it thinks of DRM and people responding to that. And some of the things we've talked about today are somewhat reflective of that. The Warner Music deal with YouTube is taking a non-DRM type approach to controlling Warner's copyrighted material. And also the Snowcap MyScape deal is putting MP3s out there, I believe, in non-DRM'd form for download. And I think that's a big piece of what makes it so difficult for everyday people to, you know, deal with the fact that the things that they get in this uniform silver disc format or however it's coming in all have different rights and uses associated with them. You know, if you can't move it around, if there's a lot of friction involved in how you can use and manipulate, then, you know, it just, even things that you could clearly do under the law are being locked down by the distribution packaging of the item that you've purchased or come by legally, however you've managed to get it into your possession.
Yeah, I think all that's going away, and I think it's going away for two reasons. One, it's inconvenient, as you said. The other thing is that all the DRM patents are basically owned by Microsoft, Philips, and to some extent Apple with the Fair Play system. And that puts them sort of in a choke point position with respect to the content community wanting to get its stuff out into the world. So, in other words, if you own a record company and you're trying to exploit your works, you've got technology providers, some would call them snake oil salesmen, coming to you and saying, you know, we got the stuff that's going to allow you to do that, and everybody's coming to you with that, and I think your natural inclination is to not use any of it because it all has a cost associated with it. So, you know, I could make the argument, if you got the legal regime sorted out on the digital side, there wouldn't be any need for DRM. And I'd even go a little bit further, which is that I think people are so confused, regular consumers are so confused about what they can and cannot do, that if you could get those rules sorted out in a way that people would understand, then I'd say you have much, much less need for DRM than what you do right now.
So Hank, this is Kathy. I mean, I didn't hear you say that you think DRM's going away, because it feels like a fact of life in many ways. I mean, CDs, you know, were introduced in the 80s before really DRM was really thought about, but then with the DVDs, that was kind of baked in mid 90s when the DVD came in, and then with the DMCA and the anti-hacking provisions, you know, it. For example, the record industry, until the Rootkit debacle, they were rolling out, you know, DRM here in the U.S., saying that it had been proven in Europe, you know, a couple years before. So it feels like DRM is still really a big piece of this.
Yeah, I think I disagree. I mean, I would predict. I'll make a prediction that during the course of this year, one of the major labels will license their stuff for non-DRM purposes. It may have a watermarking technology associated with it, but it'll be capable of being played on any player. And the reason is that right now, whether it's Apple or it's Microsoft, those technology companies place themselves in a position of being essentially a channel to the consumer, or a way to get to the consumer that the content provider sort of has to pay tribute to in order to reach the goal of providing the consumer with this DRM product. And I think that the tax that those people are exacting is becoming more and more onerous to the content owners. And I think that, you know, it's always a question of cost benefit, right? And if they get to a point where they believe, and I think they're getting there, that that there's no longer that much of a benefit to be gained, and the cost is prohibitive. I think that they will move to a regime where they're not using DRM on these things.
Yeah, I could see people experimenting with it. I mean, who was the ones who just put out their music and with ads instead of DRM, you know? But it seems like DRM is so attractive in many ways that it's not going away anytime soon.
The only I forget the name of the record cover, the label,
but it was the Universal and Spiral Frog.
Spiral Frog is the name that stays with me. But you know, I mean, that just strikes me as a comical approach. I mean, it's great that they're experimenting, but to put something out there that requires a user to come back to your computer and watch ads to keep your music viable, you know, number one, I just don't see it being appealing. And to the extent they are able to find customers, I suspect they're going to be college students who have figured out a way to write a subroutine that, you know, does it all automatically.
Yeah. Well, the Universal Music guys are great negotiators, and I suspect they got a great big advance from Spiral Frog.
But isn't Spiral Frog just a small startup company?
Yeah.
So how could they get a big advance?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, big, I don't know. Go straight to the bottom line, $5, uh-huh. $10 million.
Yeah.
But I think from Spiral Frog's perspective, all that they need to do is establish a CPM that works. I don't know whether they can do that or not. I mean, that's the challenge for that company is can they establish a CPM, a value proposition that delivers essentially the same as a retail price? Because I don't think Universal changed any of its pricing in order to do this deal. This isn't like they're giving it away. This is, we don't care whether you give us, you know, cash from your user or you give us cash from your advertiser. The price is the same. And, you know, I think Larry Kenswell was pretty clear about that in the various quotes that I saw when they did the announcement.
Right. It seems to me the advertisers are the ones that may have the wool being pulled over their eyes here as far as how effective this will be as an advertising strategy. But who knows? I mean, I think it's great that people are out experimenting and trying to figure out new ways to do this. Hank, I had a question for you going back to the interview that you did on Courant back in November of 2004.
Yeah.
And that was a great interview, by the way, folks.
Where it gets waved in my face all the time.
Folks should go check that out if they haven't seen it. It's called The Future of Digital Media. Courant did a series of interviews with a number of folks, including Hank. And one of the quotes that popped out at me when I went back and reread that was, bearing in mind this was now almost 2 full years ago, the struggle for attention always favors the big guy. Several Mentos Diet Coke videos later, do you still stand by that?
Sure. Sure. I mean, the end caps cost a lot of money. And whether they're digital end caps or real end caps, I mean, it costs a lot of money to sort of elbow your way into the public's consciousness. It's not cheap. It's not cheap. I mean, if you the service that that advertising provides is a, you know, it's a really basic one. Sort of, hey, look at me. I don't know. Maybe I missed the point of the question. What do you mean?
Oh, I just
I get that you can get attention without spending money sometimes,
mm-hmm.
but it's rare.
I guess my point is just I understand that it's rare and it's, you know, a shot in the dark, these sort of things that go viral on sites like YouTube. But, you know, with 100 million videos being served up there a day and, you know, dozens, if not several dozens of competitive sites, you know, springing online daily to serve this need. I agree that, you know, there needs to be a filtering mechanism and a guide to some of this stuff, but it really seems to me like the landscape is shifting, and that the stuff that people want to watch is different than what the big guy traditionally puts out. Am I just too Pollyanna-ish about that, you think?
Well, you know, we live in California, three out of the four people on the call, and we tend to have a Californian's view of this, which is a very optimistic and kind of hopeful view. And you know, I hope you're right, but you know, that certainly isn't the way things are right now, and certainly as it relates to mass consumption.
I'm really intrigued by this Apple iTV device that'll be out next spring sometime. Because I've been really intrigued, too, by the exploration TiVo has done in moving web-related content into the living room or onto your television and providing a way for people to say, you know what, the programming that I want to watch isn't coming in from any network, cable or otherwise. It's coming in from some independent producer where someone has either pre-selected this as something I might want to watch, or I'm able to just program it in and watch it myself on what in whatever room and on whatever mechanical device that I want to. And, you know, the convergence term has been out there bandied about for years and years, but I think it's finally poised to happen in a way that could really make a difference to things like cable companies and broadcast television stations. You know, the flip side of that is that there's already too much inundating people's attention spans now. But they certainly seem to be finding a way to winnow through and find the things that bubble to the surface. So, you know, optimistic California perspective or not, you know, I think this is an economic force that is not going to go away.
Well, here in not so optimistic New Orleans, and again, I use my laboratory as my kids are my laboratory. I watch them, especially my girls, because they go to a traditional Catholic school where, up until several years ago, the girls would sit down at a linen tablecloth table and eat with silverware and were taught, you know, all sorts of etiquette. And they still enforce that, but now all of the girls, once they get into ninth grade, have wireless laptops. They're so immersed in technology. And you know, I have to ask them questions because to them it's just like the fish talking about the water that they swim in. They just don't see it as anything remarkable. The other night, my daughter was telling me about podcasting, and the school now has certain classes, if not enough people sign up for them, they just run them as podcasts, and the kids download the lectures onto their iPods. And somebody over, a friend of mine was overhearing this conversation and said, well, how many of the kids in your class have iPods? And she said, oh, they did a survey. 99% of them have iPods. And they know how to download things, and they know how to find music. And what you just described about getting vision off the TiVo, I mean, my daughter will figure that out on her own. I'll never hear her ask me how to do it. She'll just do it.
Yeah,
I realize that those are children who are well off, and that's, you know, there's still a large digital divide, and the future has not been evenly distributed yet, but getting distributed faster and faster every day.
Yeah, that's fascinating about the podcast alternative for your high school course, too.
Also, you know, at least when I was growing up, with the number of channels we had limited, and, you know, if then we thought about this place where we had so many cable channels and so many, you know, XM satellite channels, probably then we would have said, well, that's, you know, that's too many for people to mediate, and how will anything be popular? But I think through those types of examples and through, you know, users selecting the next American Idol and all of that, we're seeing, you know, a shift into, you know, how the, you know, user base is having more sort of say in terms of particularity as to, you know, voting with their feet or their remotes or whatever. So I don't know if we've seen the limit on in terms of what the audience can absorb and how the filters will work. I mean, it's a great point though, Hank.
Well, it's incredibly. I think, you know, when we found, one of the good things about Napster was that we found that people have a fantastic capacity to enjoy lots of different music, and I think that's true with information sources as well. So now, I don't know about you guys, but I sit on my couch with my laptop and I watch TV, right? So I've got my remote in my hand, and I've got my laptop on my lap, and I'm experiencing convergence. Right? It's a wild form of convergence, but I get all the TV media I want by looking up, and I get all the computer media I want by looking down. And those things are all coming together now, I think. And what has really done it is the Internet Protocol. I mean, this is all IP. The stack of things that you call your television and the stack of things that you call your computer are going together. And the way they're going together is Internet Protocol. And then the only issue is, what's the wire? How do you get there? Well, you've got, you know, Macaw with Clearwire. You've got Comcast with Comcast. Now you have Apple with ITV. All these companies are trying to do the sort of three-cushion bank shot that they need in order to get into your living room, right? And but the net of that, I think, ought to be something like, I don't know if you guys ever saw the demo for a company that didn't succeed called Liberate. But Liberate was run by Mitchell Kurtzman from Hummel Winblad, and they had this great console that allowed you to integrate internet resources and cable television resources. They were way too early. But, you know, I think we're coming into an era when things, sort of everything will be on demand, everything will be available to you, and you won't have to do the whole, you know, laptop on the couch thing in order to get at these resources. But that's, you know, as we see, these IP questions, the questions of commerce, how you respect the rights of copyright holders while at the same time facilitating that commerce. I mean, these are questions that are all out there. They're really important from an economic perspective to our whole country, and nobody's kind of dealing with them because they involve, you know, changing the law.
Well, speaking of changing the law, Hank, you're certainly no stranger to Washington and have addressed Congress on a number of occasions. I wonder if you could bring us up to speed on what we should be paying attention to that's in the pipeline right now.
Well, you know, I don't know enough about this, you know, Copyright Improvement Act. Kathy, why don't you say a little bit about that? Because I know the various pieces, but and I saw it had been introduced, but my attention's been elsewhere.
Yeah, so my understanding is not a lot is happening this fall just because of you know, the place that the Congress is in. But the first piece is the Section 115 on digital music licensing, which is a revised version of the House Act that had previously been introduced. And the second piece is Orphan Works, which has also been previously introduced. And there's a Copyright Office study, and I think basically everybody feels, you know, something should happen on Orphan Works, although you have some photography people out there apparently who are, you know, concerned about it. And then the third piece is called Copyright Protection Resources, which has different components to try to address various concerns of the industry, such as you know, statutory damages, fraud on the Copyright Office, things like that.
That's great. Good to know what.
So we, you know, even if we don't see any action on these, we may see these come back to life in other forms in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unfortunately, the Hill really conflates patent things and copyright things, and there's a lot of movement on the patent side right now. So I don't think there's going to be much done over here on copyrights for a while.
Well, maybe we'll have to wait for next year to see something like the Induce Act raise its ugly head again, or any sort of affirmative copyright reform legislation have a prayer either.
Well, and that, you know, the political process doesn't lend itself to it. Go ahead, Ken.
I was going to say, then if you really want to scratch your head, you can look at the fashion design bill that was introduced, you know. So in terms of, you know, we've got all these you know, media issues in terms of, you know, that are sort of at the top of mind, but then you have people coming in and wanting to get legal protection for fashion designs, which is sort of beyond copyright.
Right.
So it's just kind of interesting to follow all the everything that's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really important thread, which is that, you know, we sit here and I sit here and talk about reform, when actually you could make an argument that the trend of the world is the other way. It is broadening the scope, broadening the subject matter, broadening the protection available. And, you know, in that sense, maybe a good thing that nothing's happening. But there's absolutely a sense. If you look at what's happening on the trademark side in dilution, and, you know, there's a sense where people think if a little intellectual property is a good thing, then maybe a whole lot more of it is even a better thing. And I think, unfortunately, that's not true, but premise.
Well, guys, I really appreciate your getting together with me here today to record our first inaugural show of This Week in Law. And I really enjoyed the conversation and look forward to chatting with you all again soon. Hank, I especially appreciate your joining us. Take care.
Lots of fun.
Ernie and Kathy, we'll see you back here again.
Thanks for having me.